Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A tearful love letter from a slave to his family. A tender note of advice from W.E.B. Du Bois to his daughter. A groundbreaking new collection of letters, documents, the full sweep of African-American stories, from slavery, war, and civil rights struggles to the intimate personal lives of lovers, brothers, friends, and mothers, in correspondence handed down across three centuries. This hour On Point, the living history of Black America in letters. You can join our conversation, What Do You Hear?, in personal letters that you don't get from the history books. Is your own family story told in letters? Joining me now from New York City is Pamela Newkirk, Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University. She's author of Within the Veil, Black Journalists, White Media, and editor of A Love No Less, More Than Two Centuries of African-American Love Letters. Her new collection out this month is Letters from Black America. Pamela, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jane, for having me.
Tell us what makes this letter collection different and unique.
Well, I think many of us have read historical accounts of African Americans, and you know we know about the high and low points of African American life, but rarely do we get to hear the voices of not only the extraordinary African Americans, but ordinary African Americans who are writing to their loved ones, these are the intimate moments in a people's history that you very rarely have an opportunity to hear.
How did you amass this collection?
Well, I spent 5 years rummaging through archives across the country and in Ghana, pouring through anthologies, going through people's attics, having people pull out the shoe boxes and wherever they may have stored their own family letters. And after 5 years, I amassed thousands of letters and tried to pick roughly 200, a little more than 200, that I thought, when knitted together, could give a sense of the breadth and depth of the African-American experience through letters.
During the collection process, I read that there was some disappointment along the way. Even though you did end up with thousands of letters, it was hard to get them in many cases, wasn't it? And why?
Well, the hardest thing was not always getting the letters. Many of these letters are deposited at archives across the country, the National Archives, Library of Congress, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, Moreland Spingard, and on and on. But what I didn't anticipate was how difficult it would be to get the estates to grant permission to publish many of these letters. And oftentimes, the letters were placed in the archives by the writers themselves. So they had a sense of their own legacy, the importance of sharing these letters. But oftentimes, their estates did not share that appreciation.
But also, I read that there was some concern about public scrutiny or, in some cases, even stereotyping.
Yeah, in the more contemporary letters, there was resistance, reluctance by many, even in public life, which I found surprising. Many people who I thought would be more than willing to share their letters, even their public letters, were not that excited to do so. And I can only speculate that in some cases it was the fear of scrutiny, how the letters would be used, or even how they would measure up with the letters of some of the greatest writers. As you noted in your introduction, the letter from a Birmingham jail, Dr. Martin Luther King's brilliant letters, one of the greatest letters in American life. And so you have, his letters, the letters of Benjamin Banneker, the letters of so many great thinkers and writers. So I suspect some were a little reluctant to to place their letters alongside those.
These letters cover such a broad range of experience within the African American community. I wish you'd start to read some. Would you for us, Pamela?
I'd be delighted.
I wish you'd start with the 1858 letter from Abraham Scriven. He was a slave in New Orleans.
Yes, and he wrote this letter to inform his wife that he had been sold, so it's a really heartbreaking letter. My dear wife, I take the pleasure of writing you these few with much regret to inform you that I am sold to a man by the name of Peterson, a trader, and stays in New Orleans. I am here yet, but I expect to go before long. But when I get there, I want to send you some things, but I don't know who to send them by. But I will try to get them to you and my children. Give my love to my mother and father and tell them goodbye for me. And if we shall not meet in this world, I hope to meet in heaven. My dear wife, for you and my children, my pen cannot express the grief I feel to be parted from you all.
This is a really typical and heartbreaking story for African American families during slavery.
Right, and something that we rarely consider is that even slaves attempted to maintain some semblance of family life across plantations, across counties and states, something that you wouldn't necessarily read about in a history book, but there are many of these letters which show this yearning to somehow connect with loved ones.
Do you know the fate of that letter and of the people involved, Pamela?
Well, the thing is, many of these letters, they turn up in the family papers of the slave owners. Mm. So we don't always know if the intended party even saw the letter because, of course, this was an illegal act. For slaves to even read and write was illegal. So it's difficult to know if these letters were intercepted before they were delivered or if they were just saved by the slave owners after they were found. So there's no way of really knowing.
You mentioned Benjamin Banneker earlier. Would you read a letter that he wrote in 1791? He was a free African-American astronomer, a mathematician, an inventor, and he wrote to Thomas Jefferson, who was then the Secretary of State, protesting slavery and imploring him to see blacks as intellectual equals.
Right. Well, that's a pretty lengthy letter, but I'll read a portion of it that I think kind of gets to the heart of what he was trying to convey. I hope you cannot but acknowledge that it is the indispensable duty of those who maintain for themselves the rights of human nature and who profess the obligations of Christianity to extend their power and influence to the relief of every part of the human race from whatever burden or oppression they may unjustly labor under. And this, I apprehend, a full conviction of the truth, an obligation of these principles should lead all to. So he was appealing to him to, you know, as a Christian, as a lover of freedom and liberty, to extend those rights to African Americans.
Did Jefferson acknowledge the letter? Was he at all swayed?
He acknowledged it, but I don't think he was necessarily swayed by it because, of course, he did hold slaves.
There's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Alice Walker, who wrote a letter, an open letter to President Obama, which is also published in your book. She actually read that letter aloud in November on Democracy Now!, and I want to listen to part of that.
It starts with, "Dear Brother President-elect, you have no idea, really, how profound this moment is for us being the black people of the southern United States. You think you know because you are thoughtful and you have studied our history. But seeing you delivering the torch so many others carried, only to be brought down before igniting the flame of justice and of law, is almost more than the heart can bear. And yet this observation is not intended to burden you, for you are of a different time, and indeed, because of all the relay runners before you, this is a different America."
I read that letter of Pamela Newkirk, and I thought, in 200 years, our country's gone from Benjamin Banneker asking Jefferson to consider black Americans as fully human to seeing the first black president elected, written here in letters.
What an amazing arc.
What's been the role of letters, of personal communications, in documenting Black American history?
Well, I think for so long these letters have been undervalued, devalued. So many of these letters don't even exist in the archives. They weren't seen as the important historical relics that they are because the history of African Americans has so often been overshadowed by, you know, the greater story of American life. And being marginalized, African Americans have not had their full say in the history of this country. So it is wonderful that the people who have appreciated these letters and held on to these letters now at this moment in history, I think they will receive the attention that they have long deserved.
With your remarkable work in these books, in this particular new book, what do you think that you get from personal letters that you don't get from other articles or relics of those particular times past?
Well, so many of these letters are not written for public consumption. What I love about the letters are the unguarded moments, you know, when you have like a Paul Laurence Dunbar, that great poet who before he had achieved national fame as a poet, wrote his mother to say, "Mama, you know, I just met Frederick Douglass and he knew who I was. Can you believe it, Mama, that, you know, your poor little ugly Black boy is now becoming a representative member of the race?" So it's those sweet moments of awe and excitement in the life of a people.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the history of Black Americans through the letters that they wrote. Pamela Newkirk is with us. She's editor of the new book, Letters from Black America. We have many calls for you, Pamela, lined up here. Let's get to one of them first from Mary. She's in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Mary. Thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Hello, Jane. The letters are so beautiful, and my question is, how did the slaves learn to read and write?
Mary, thank you.
Well, sometimes they would learn from, you know, a kind master or the son or daughter of a slave owner. And when one slave could read, they would often read to everyone on the plantation, and so it was passed down that way. Typically, they would learn to read the Bible. In fact, that's the way many Americans learn to read, by reading the Bible. So,
how did you initially become interested in these writings, Pamela?
Well, the seed was planted as a child. My father was an antique dealer, but he had a personal collection of Black memorabilia. So I grew up in a home where the letters and postcards and posters and rare books of African Americans were all around me. So early on, I had that appreciation. And when I was working on my first book, which was a book about race in the news media, I was doing archival research, and I kept coming across these letters. And the first book that I did with the letters was the collection of African American love letters, and that book came pretty much as a corrective. It was looking at an underrepresented facet of Black life through the love letters of, again, ordinary and extraordinary African Americans. As a journalist, those are the stories in the portraits that you don't often see. And so this book then grew out of that one, because I kept finding letters that you know, were buried in archives that I thought needed to come out and be shared.
Of course, some of the great letters of all time have come from, Dr. Martin Luther King, and you include this one from 1960, a very famous letter penned to his wife, Coretta, from a Georgia state prison. He missed his family terribly, but he really believed that his work was necessary, and he wrote to her some of that. Would you read that letter, Pamela?
Sure. And what this letter shows is, you know, we know about King's sacrifice, but we don't often think about the family sacrifice. "Hello, darling. Today I find myself a long way from you and the children. I am at the state prison in Reidsville, which is about 230 miles from Atlanta. They picked me up from the DeKalb jail about 4 o'clock this morning. I know this whole experience is very difficult for you to adjust to, especially in your condition of pregnancy. But as I said to you yesterday, this is the cross we must bear for the freedom of our people. So I urge you to be strong in faith, and this will in turn strengthen me. I can assure you that it is extremely difficult for me to think of being away from you and my Yoki and Marty for 4 months, but I am asking God hourly to give me the power of endurance. I have the faith to believe that this excessive suffering that is now coming to our family will in some little way serve to make Atlanta a better city, Georgia a better state, and America a better country. Just how, I do not yet know, but I have faith to believe it will. If I am correct, then our suffering is not in vain.
Dr. King famously wrote letters from jail, most notably that 1963 letter to the white clergyman from a Birmingham jail. But this right. one, years earlier, is much more raw and personal. And I'm curious what you think it reveals about Dr. King that we may not know from his public face.
I mean, this was a man of who was willing to put it all on the line. I mean, that sounds kind of, you know, obvious. But in this letter, I mean, he's telling his wife, you know, this is hard. Like, I know it's hard, but we have to do this. I mean, this is what we need to do to free our people. So, you know, letter from a Birmingham jail, which was one of the most beautiful and powerful letters in American history, was a public letter. This is a private moment. This was a letter not intended, you know, to be published in newspapers and in books. And so this shows him as a private man, his private thoughts, with his family. And another letter in this book does the same, shows that personal side of him as well, when he just writes a love letter to his wife. So I just think it's important to see public figures as private people as well, and this letter shows him that way.
I love the letter, Pamela, of Sojourner Truth, who was a slave. She escaped to New York City. She became an abolitionist, a woman's activist, and a Pentecostal preacher. And in an 1864 letter to abolition supporter Roland Johnson, she recounts a meeting with President Lincoln. Would you read from that letter?
Right. I'll read a portion of that. I told him that I had never heard of him before he was talked of for president. He, meaning Lincoln, smilingly replied, "I had heard of you many times before that." He then showed me the Bible presented to him by the colored people of Baltimore, of which you have no doubt seen a description. I have seen it for myself, and it is beautiful beyond description. I must say, and I am proud to say, that I never was treated by anyone with more kindness and cordiality than were shown to me by that great and good man, Abraham Lincoln, by the grace of God, for 4 years more.
She seemed quite taken with Lincoln.
Tell
us more
was.
About this time and place and who she was, Sojourner Truth. She was a formerly enslaved woman, so that President
right.
Lincoln knew of her before she even knew him.
Right. She was this great freedom fighter who helped many slaves escape through the Underground Railroad and gave speeches across the country, you know, imploring whites to join her in the abolitionist movement.
What was her influence on Lincoln, do you think?
Oh, well, I mean, I could not know just what it was, but of course he did sign the Emancipation Proclamation. And in this letter, she's, you know, earlier in the letter, she's saying to him that, you know, thank God you were the instrument, you know, that was used to free the slaves.
Mm-hmm. Here's another call from Spokane, Washington. Ben is on the line. Hi, Ben. Thank you for waiting. Pamela Newkirk is with you.
Hello. I would just like to kind of comment on the importance of historical documentation, pretty much personal letters. And I'd just like to say that I'm a big fan of the personal letters because usually it offers us, like you guys have been speaking of, the most personal details of a person's life during a certain period. I think a lot of times, you know, historical figures get put on a pedestal and there's mythical people versus the true human beings that they were and the extraordinary human beings that they were.
Right.
Then thank you.
Right, it's difficult to hide in these letters because, as you said, that these are many of these are personal letters and they're not meant for to flesh out the public profile. And in the King letter, you really see the connection between the public man and the private man.
Here's another call now. Dennis is in Conway, South Carolina. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
If you would, I'd like your guests to address maybe the intellectual depth of quite a bit of these letters, in particular Moses von Sam. That is, the intellectual depth of the slave is questioned when it's written in their personal letters. And, Moses von Sam, if she's familiar with him, would you mind addressing him?
Dennis, thanks. Pamela, are you?
No, I'm not.
I guess the question was the authenticity of some of these as well, I think, was what he was asking.
Yeah, well there, in many cases, it has been documented that slaves sometimes had help writing the letters because, of course, illiteracy was legally mandated for slaves. So if that, I don't know if that's what he means, but the ability to write and the ability to convey emotions and thought and depth are two different things. And I think that even if some of these letters may have been dictated, the authenticity seems pretty clear.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. David Levering Lewis joins us from New York. He's the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of W.E.B. Du Bois and the professor of history at New York University. A 1963 letter from his mother is published in Letters from Black America. David, welcome back to On Point.
Hello.
You gave this letter to the collection. Tell us about it. It's a letter from your mother in 1963.
It is. I'm reading September 7 in that year, and I'm following, I believe, a letter from or about Sojourner Truth, so I'm in very good company, my mother and I, historically it would seem. I was about to leave England for the University of Ghana to take up my first teaching position there at the new university, and I had seen my mother. We had been together earlier that year, the summer of 63, when she joined me as I was released from the United States Army, where I was serving as a PFC in a medical detachment, and we toured Europe, and she returned to Atlanta, Georgia, and I waited to complete arrangements to go off to Accra, Ghana. And so she writes me shortly before I will leave from London.
Will you read us part of the letter?
Yes. Dearest David, warn you in advance that this is an ancient resurrected typewriter with no margin control that I have yet been able to discover. And so here's hoping you will be able to translate this. And then she says, the name Du Bois probably means little to you. He was active long before your time. I was fortunate enough to have him as a teacher many years ago at Atlanta University. You may know that he was living in Ghana at the time of his death. I hope that as the days pass and you are further and further away from your past army experience, you'll suffer less and less of the depression you describe. You may find the Ghana situation a challenge. What you need is something that one must have to live in peace with himself, something to believe in and work for, and that I am sure you will find. Maybe not in Ghana, who knows? And somewhere, the girl who will be a partner in the realization of your life plans, whatever they may be. Your immediate job is, as you say, to go to Ghana, primarily, to teach. I shall never forget the wonderful experience of the past summer. It was such a joy to be with you that, apart from the enjoyment of the tour itself and the thrill of visiting ancient and historic spots and the beauty of the Italian and French countryside, I do hope to see it all again before my final curtain falls. The Yeatses, Bells, et al. Send bushels of love. The Yeatses were an Atlanta family, fairly prominent, and the Bells were relatives. Drop a line to me when you find time. Under separate cover, I'm sending little notes to Henry and Keensoper, to whom I should have written thank yous long ago, but stupidly left their addresses in the car. I know that you'll see that they get them. Love as always, Mama.
What's your take on that letter, your professorial take, Professor Lewis, also a historical perspective on that letter and the others in this book?
Well, it's, of course, ironic, amusing, curious that my mother would remind me of W.E.B. Du Bois, and to think that perhaps in my busy young life I was too busy to pay attention to history, even though that's what I was becoming. But I was a student of French and European history. I had just gotten my PhD there, so that's probably why she thought maybe Du Bois wasn't readily coming to mind. Well, of course, as you noted, I had the good fortune to write about his life and to succeed in bringing, I think, him again to the attention of a public that had, for a number of reasons, turned away from his significance. So that's what strikes me, the paradox of that.
Twice winning the Pulitzer Prize to do so. David, hold on just a moment. Let me bring another call into this conversation. Dana is on the line now from Brewster, Massachusetts. Hi, Dana. Welcome.
Hello, Jane and guests.
Hi.
I was once delighted and horrified to hear about that there was a black astronomer in the 18th century. I was delighted because that was so. But I was also horrified that, you know, it had never occurred to me that blacks were actually doing science in the 18th century. And because all the history never posed them, had never written them, acknowledged them. I mean,
Dana, thanks. We're losing your line. Pamela, let me ask you, what were the contributions of African Americans during that time? They must have been forgotten in many sense, obviously, because there was no evidence of it.
I know, and it's really sad that, you know, many African-American children, at least of my generation, grew up hearing these stories from our parents who had to sort of fill in the gaps of history at home. So I knew about Benjamin Banneker and Phyllis Wheatley and Paul Laurence Dunbar and so many of these other contributors as a child, but many people don't. Black children, white children don't know about the contributions that African Americans have made, you know, throughout the history of this nation. And as a result, there is this sense that they did not contribute in a major way. Benjamin Banneker, when he wrote that letter to Thomas Jefferson, also enclosed an almanac that he had written. He was doing these almanacs that told with startling precision when crops would you know, bloom, and when, you know, he was doing science at a very early age. And so, yeah, it's not surprising that the caller does not know about Benjamin Banneker, because so much of African-American history has been swept under the rug.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're reading letters from Black America from a new collection that spans three centuries of African-American history. Pamela Newkirk is with us. She's a journalism professor at New York University and editor of the new collection, Letters from Black America. Let's go back to the phones. Mary Eve is calling now from Edinburgh, Virginia. Hi, Mary Eve. Welcome.
Hi there. What a wonderful, enlightening program. I love it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wonder if, Pamela, when you were searching out in your research, did you come across letters of black slave owners, free blacks who were slave masters? That's a rather interesting subject. There a lot of plantation owners in South Carolina and had large plantations who were black slave owners. And I just have a book here in front of me, Black Slave Owners, Free Black Slave Masters in South Carolina, 1790 to 1860. And it's written by Larry Coger.
Oh, my goodness.
It rings a bell with David. Eve, Mary Eve, thank you. Pamela, a reality that's often overlooked.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was a rare reality, but oftentimes the slaves, free blacks, would buy their families out of slavery. And I did come across some of those letters, but maybe David would want to speak to the issue of black slave owners in
David,
general.
Professor?
Hello, Pamela. I made a response because the name Larry Coger is one I hadn't heard in many years. Larry was a student of mine a long time ago when I was at Howard University. He took a seminar from me, and he was very impressed by the work we did together. And out of the blue, years later, when I was elsewhere, he sent me an autographed copy of the book that the callers just identified, Free Slave Owners. And it's really a remarkable document. And as the caller says, there was in South Carolina a population of free people of color who were slave owners, as Pamela indicates, though. For the most part, they were people who were manumitting themselves, buying their relatives out of bondage, though there were some who were distinctly slave-owning in the classic sense of the word, strange to say. And those are voices, I suppose, as we look back at our history now and incorporate missing parts of it, we would want to know something of.
Pamela Newkirk, would you read another of the letters from your book, Letters from Black America? The one I'd wish you to read is from James Baldwin, one of the most important writers and social critics of the 20th century. And in 1963, on the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, he wrote a letter to his teenage nephew, I believe. Would you read that?
Right. His namesake, who was also James Baldwin. Yes. This innocent country set you down in a ghetto in which, in fact, it intended that you should perish. Let me spell out precisely what I mean by that. For the heart of the matter is here, in the root of my dispute with my country. You were born where you were born and faced the future that you faced because you were black and for no other reason. The limits of your ambition were thus expected to be set forever. You were born into a society which spelled out with brutal clarity and in as many ways as possible that you were a worthless human being. You were not expected to aspire to excellence. You were expected to make peace with mediocrity. Wherever you have turned, James, in your short time on this earth, you have been told where you could go and what you could do and how you could do it and where you could do it and whom you could marry. I know your countrymen do not agree with me about this, and I hear them saying, you exaggerate. The details and symbols of your life have been deliberately constructed to make you believe what white people say about you. Please try to remember that what they believe, as well as what they do and cause you to endure, does not testify to your inferiority, but to their inhumanity. Humanity and fear. I'm sorry.
This is
Well, of course, that's one of America's great wordsmiths, but he puts plain truths into an eloquence that really, I think, resonates and persuades.
It certainly does. 100 years after emancipation, the Emancipation Proclamation, what strides, Pamela Newkirk, had American society made by then, and how much more progress would they make over the course of that young James's life?
Well, of course. I mean, I'm here now with one of the greatest historians of our time, so I don't know if I'm the one to answer
Professor,
that.
Professor, would you like to take it?
Well, I'd like to deny that I'm one of the greatest historians because I am a pretty good historian, and so I have some degree of objectivity, but thank you for the compliment. Yes, we have made strides. Our country is a triumphalist country. We believe that we move from
one success to another that's even better. And so that has meant that the darker side and the things that have not been brought to fulfillment in accordance with our ideals, we tend to mute, to evade, or even to reproach the people who aren't so contented with the way things have gone by saying, you know, don't rain on our parade. And so that's really what is so so poignant and so significant, it seems to me, about this collection of wonderful letters that go from people of great significance whose names are known to people whose names will, except if they read Pamela's collection, not be known.
Not. Mm.
So at the end of the day, meaning now with the first days of this new administration with all of its racial and social and gender significance, we Americans, all of us, I think, are to be excused for a euphoria which later on we may revisit and say, well, maybe things were not as grand, as perfect as they seemed in January and February of 29. But we'll still compliment ourselves that we broke through a barrier that was simply a fantasy in the lives, I think, of most thinking people of color 10, 15 years ago, that there would be a black person occupying the Oval Office.
Let me go to a call professor here who's up on the line. James is in Charleston, South Carolina. James, welcome to the program.
Yes, good day, and thank you for taking my call. What a great program.
Thank you.
I just had a comment based on a couple of things. First of all, I teach preservation, and I want to reinforce what you were saying about the value of these letters and these personal accounts to bridge the gap of history. We live with sort of the sense of inevitable in history, and it's nice to instill a sense of, you know, possibilities that we see in history and all the things that didn't happen as well as what happened. But my comment, are you with me?
Yes, please go.
Right, was when I was working on trying to organize an estate here in town, I was going through a particular family's information and ran across an old safe in the carriage house that hadn't been opened up in apparently a really long time. And we drilled it open, and once we got over the set of matched dueling pistols in the bottom, which was a little overwhelming, and got them to the local sheriff, I started looking through the account books, and I ran across a bit of marginalia, which I thought was refreshing and instills the sense of history that we're talking about, because I immediately started looking for that famous date, April 15th, 1861, when the Civil War began here in Charleston with the bombing of Fort Sumter. Mm-hmm. Well, there was a listing of accounts and, you know, who paid who for what slave and how much they paid for coal, et cetera, and then there was a comment, bomb Fort Sumter today, sort of offhand. Mm. Went through another page of this, that, and the other, and ran across another marginalia comment over in the side, which I thought was moving, and that said simply, expect trouble from the old government, which in a way, you know, just says something about the unassuming nature of everyday life and a lot of things, really. Mm-hmm. But I've always found that a comment that helped bridge a gap in history and was quite amazing. Mm-hmm. Expect trouble from the old government.
What an interesting story. James, thank you. Thank you very much.
Of a piece with King Louis XVI, noting in his diary of the day, July 14th, 1789, nothing. And, of course, the French Revolution began that day.
Pamela, read for us another letter from the book. This one, Lewis Douglas, who was the eldest son of Frederick Douglass, of course, abolitionist, journalist, and orator, and the most famous African-American in the 1800s. Lewis fought in the all-black 54th Massachusetts Infantry during the Civil War, and in 1863, he wrote a letter to his fiancée from South Carolina. Two days...
It's funny.
Yeah.
It's your caller is from South Carolina.
Exactly. 2 days after their ill-fated attack on Fort Wagner. Read this letter, would you, Pamela?
Right. My dear Amelia, we're on the eve of another fight, and I am very busy, and I have just snatched a moment to write you. I must necessarily be brief. Should I fall in the next fight, killed or wounded, I hope to fall with my face to the foe. If I survive, I shall write you a long letter. This regiment has established its reputation as a fighting regiment. Not a man flinched, though it was a trying time. Men fell all around me. A shell would explode and clear a space of 20 feet. Our men would close up again, but it was no use. We had to retreat, which was a very hazardous undertaking. How I got out of that fight alive, I cannot tell, but I am here. My dear girl, I hope again to see you. I must bid you farewell should I be killed. Remember, if I die, I die in a good cause. I wish we had 100,000 colored troops. We would put an end to this war. Goodbye to all. Your own loving Lewis.
Mm-hmm. So here is this African-American fighting for his country, even as far north as New York. Blacks at that time were being beaten and lynched. I mean, tell us what this particular letter, this particular story, Pamela, of valor and resilience really tells us about the black narrative through history.
Right. It's the story that you don't hear that while America often fell short of its ideals, African Americans rarely gave up on America. They fought its wars. They loved their families. They expressed their humanity in the arts. And, you know, they tried to get along and to be a part of this great country. And here you had the son of Frederick Douglass, you know, one of the greatest African Americans of his time, if not the greatest. And, you know, his eldest son, you know, enlisted, and proudly enlisted in the 54th Regiment to fight, you know, for the freedom of not just African Americans, but to bring this country together. So, again, it's one of the stories that you don't often hear told.
I'd like you to read one more letter, if you wouldn't mind, Pamela. In 1914, the eminent scholar and activist, as we've been talking about, W.E.B. Du Bois, wrote a letter to his 14-year-old daughter, Yolanda, who was adjusting to her first year at a boarding school in England. This may be one of my favorites in the book.
Oh, I think it's mine as well.
He's
trying to prepare her for, you know, the curiosity of race at the boarding school. Okay, here we go. People will wonder at your dear brown and the sweet crinkly hair, but that is simply of no importance. Remember that most folk laugh at anything unusual, whether it is beautiful, fine, or not. You, however, must not laugh at yourself. You must know that brown is as pretty as white or prettier, and crinkly hair as straight, though it is harder to comb. The main thing is you, is the you beneath the clothes and skin, the ability to do, the will to conquer, the determination to understand and know this great, wonderful, curious world. Don't shrink from new experiences and custom. Take the cold bath bravely. Enter into the spirit of your big bedroom. Enjoy what is and not pine for what is not.
Professor Lewis, would you respond to that, being the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of W.E.B. Du Bois that you are?
That's a quite a remarkable letter. And imagine being a 14-year-old in
right.
Hampshire, England, the second year of the war has just begun. Zeppelins are flying over London, bombing the place. There's severe shortages of everything, coal and food, and this is the first boarding school, public school, ever to try co-education. And there is Du Bois's daughter at the center of all this world historic activity with this letter that is a letter really to a people. And so it's both daunting and at the same time, it seems to me exhilarating in terms of what it says and what it invites to be accomplished. I'm not so sure as a father that I would myself want to write or have indeed written a letter quite like that to my children. Maybe I should have, but certainly it lays
the ground for things to do and get going to do them.
Pamela Newkirk, what does that letter say to you?
Well, I think that letter speaks through the ages. I have two teenage children now, and, you know, race is still an issue in our society, and it's the kind of message that you want to impart to your children that, you know, on the one hand, you know, there are people who will judge you by the color of your skin and not the content of your character, but on the other hand, you know, there's you beneath the skin, and you know, go out there and just achieve and excel, and you know, he's saying read great books just to, you know, just for the heck of it, you know, like just go out and live your life and not be limited by anyone's view of you. I think that letter still speaks to us today.
The book is Letters from Black America, edited by Pamela Newkirk, Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, Pamela, and thank you for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Jane.
And David Levering Lewis, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of W.E.B. Du Bois, professor of history at New York University. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Pleasure.
You can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.